From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSM.
Thank you, Benji. Thanks very much. It is Tuesday, February 4th, it is. Welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show. I hope you're well. I trust you are. Thanks for joining me. It means the world to me every day. I mean that. I've got a brilliant guest lined up for you a little bit later on in the programme. I've got a very interesting news roundup before that. As usual, you can tweet the programme. So tweet the programme. Let me know what you're thinking. And as those tweets come in, I will read them out. So I will.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I can't wait for you to meet Dr. Amanda Dawn Vollmer in the second hour of the program. She'll be live from Ontario in Canada. Fascinating woman. We're going to talk about naturopathic medicine and her interest in it, botanical medicine, educating yourself on alternative remedies to that which I suppose you get in your pharmacy, in your chemist. But I've been following her of late with great interest, and amazingly, a couple of listeners in the last couple of weeks have recommended that she come on. I've been following her and reading her website, which is yummymummyemporium.org. And she's been talking about coronavirus and much more besides. We'll talk about coronavirus and what she thinks is really going on with that. So Dr. Amanda Dawn Vollmer live a little bit later on in the programme. Lovely jubbly. Yes, indeed, indeed, indeed. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm always enthusiastic about things, me. I'm overly enthusiastic sometimes, but I am enthusiastic about that. Listen, on foot of something I said this morning about the programme, the creation of this programme, the production of it, the difficulty with it. A number of you came to me with a suggestion that I've heard many times before, but and that's not to criticise your suggestion, but it's not the first time that people have recommended to me that I get some help from would-be journalists. You know, get some production assistance, Richie, from people studying journalism or broadcasting at third level. Now, this has been said before. It's often been said to me by people like my learned friend, Jean-Ann Crowley, of course, who's worked at every level of television and radio, as well as being a very fine actress. The problem you've got with that is very simple. Having somebody remotely produce you is a very difficult thing. It's got to be somebody who works very closely with you. To have a producer, you've got to work side by side, number one. Number two, and we found this out in London back in 2013. Finding people that are interested in the media, who want to work in the media, but who have some exposure to the independent media in terms of that they understand the topics or they have a basic grasp of the topics we discuss on programmes like this. Those people are like gold dust. They don't exist effectively. They don't, right? This is something we were very concerned about in London. We had plenty of people coming to us who had experience in mainstream television. But when it came to working, producing our programmes at TPV, they weren't very good because they didn't know what to do when it came to putting on programmes, dealing with the subjects we deal with. They didn't have the contacts. They didn't understand, you know, who was saying what, who was writing what the websites were, who was credible, who wasn't. They just didn't have a Scooby-Doo. That's a problem. And the final problem, and the more serious one, is the universities are not at all happy about the idea that their students would come and do work experience for people like me. Now, I know this to be true because a lovely bloke, and a very smart bloke called Andy, came to me from Salford University a few years ago. And he was doing, he was making a feature film as part of his course. And he was doing it on the independent media, and he wanted me to front it. In other words, to do the pieces, the camera, to narrate it, basically. And because of who I am, and because of what I've been doing, Salford University told him he couldn't do it. He couldn't even do that particular subject. He had to do something else. So that's the way it's got to be. This is a four-person job, and one person is doing it at the moment. But there isn't anybody. People, the sorts of people that I need to do what I need them to do for me, they're not out there. They're just not available. So thanks for the suggestion. It's been said before, but it ain't going to happen. Right, Priti Patel is the Home Secretary. I've often referred to her as Israel's woman at Westminster. If you don't know why, look up Priti Patel Israel holiday. It'll tell you all you need to know. I don't know how I missed this, but in the wake of Sunday's terror attack in Streatham, yes, I know it's not Streatham, you put me right on that one, in Streatham. You know, despite the fact that I've spent quite a lot of time in and around London over the years, I'd never heard of Streatham. So I pronounced it the way it looked to me, Streatham, but I got it wrong. But some of you feline-eared, some of you owl-eared listeners, you said, Richie, it's not Streatham, it's Streatham. Yes, you're right. Now, in the wake of the alleged terrorist attack in London, Streatham, on Sunday, Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, rushed to the cameras and proceeded to do something very funny. She confused terrorism and terrorist with counter-terrorism. Amusing. Highlighting for me how the puppets are not intellectually or emotionally engaged in what's happening. They are front men and women. They are managers of public life, but managing public life on behalf of their masters. They don't know anything. They don't want to know anything. They just want their paycheck, please. And their cushy place in the House of Lords later on. Right, that's all. Very amusing. Priti Patel not understanding the difference between counter-terrorism and terrorism. Pretty confused.
This offender clearly had some history, some clear history in relation to counter-terrorism offences. And it's right that the police are now investigating that and looking into all of that. But I think I should also just say that, you know, only 2 weeks ago, post the Fishmongers Hall attack that took place in December, I announced a very clear package of measures, basically all aimed at counter-terrorism and counter-terrorist offenders, that we would effectively stop their early release, but also double their sentences, overhaul their licensing conditions, give the police that the more support that they needed. So that was more support for counter-terrorism police, more investment in counter-terrorism probation officers, and greater support for the victims of counter-terrorism.
For the victims of counter-terrorism, she says. She's vacant, she's vacant. Not a Scooby-Doo. Priti Patel. 11 and a half minutes past the hour. God love her. You never made a mistake, did you, you big baldy bat? Of course I did. I made thousands. I made far worse mistakes than that. But we love to laugh at the expense of people like Priti Patel. Now, let's move on. Keep those comments coming in there. To Manchester. Now, the brother of the Manchester Arena bomber. Allegedly. Salman Abedi, allegedly, detonated a homemade bomb outside the Ariana Grande concert at the Manchester Arena on May 22nd, 2017. 22 people were killed. People were killed and a lot of people were injured. I have no doubt about that. Absolutely none. And when I say allegedly, I mean the whole story about Salman Abedi, where he came from, who his daddy is, yeah, and all the rest of it. There's some very, well, disturbing circumstances around the movements of Salman Abedi. Anyway, Abedi allegedly was one of the victims because he killed himself when blowing himself up. His brother, as you know, was extradited to the UK. He's on trial for the murder of 22 people. It is alleged that he was part of the planning and staging of it. And the Old Bailey has been hearing the prosecution's opening salvos today, and we can hear Dan Johnson from the BBC, because Dan Johnson is following this. This is very important. This man is Hashim Abedi, standing trial for his role in perpetrating the events of May 22nd, 2017. As I said, Dan Johnson, BBC, following this.
Yes, we're only in the very opening stages of this trial, which is expected to last possibly up to 2 months. But the jury was told, first of all, about the real impact that that bomb had. So the prosecutor laid out what a devastating bomb it was, that it killed 22 people, that it seriously injured 91, and that 111 others had to have hospital treatment. And he said that hundreds more people had suffered psychological trauma in the 2.5 years since that bomb was detonated. He said in all, the police think there may have been around 1,000 people affected by this. So that underlined just how big a deal this was, how serious an issue, and how serious the charges are that Hashim Abedi faces. The prosecution say he is just as guilty as his brother, and that he acted intending that whoever deployed that device should kill, maim, and injure as many people as possible. And the jury has heard that Hashim worked with his brother, essentially gathering the different parts that they needed to put together to build that bomb, packing it with shrapnel so that it would injure as many people as possible, testing different ways of building it and trying out detonators to see what the most effective way of carrying out this attack was. Now, the prosecution accepts that Hashim may not have been part of actually deciding precisely when and where to detonate that bomb. That may have been left to Salman. They're prepared to accept that. But they say the younger brother shared his ultimate goal to cause devastation and damage. And they say there's evidence that in the run-up to the bombing, the brothers had been radicalized to a degree after their parents left this country and went to live in Libya, leaving the boys in Manchester growing up on their own. Well, Hashim Abedi is now 22 years old. He faces 22 counts of murder, as well as attempted murder and conspiracy to cause explosions. He denies all those charges. He is listening to the prosecution opening from the dock. There are members of the public here. There are families of the victims who died in the bombing, as well as survivors of the bombing too, and people watching back in Manchester as well. There's a live feed there from the Old Bailey, but there is a lot more evidence to come here, expected to be laid out over the coming weeks.
Yeah, a live feed at a location in Manchester, so the families of those who were killed can watch, understandably. I wonder, will the jury hear that the boy's father was a man called Ramadan Abedi, and that he was known to MI6 as Agent Tunworth, and that in the 1990s, MI6 paid these boys' father huge sums of money to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi, something they failed to do at that time. I wonder, will the jury learn about this? Learn about the very close relationship between the Abedis and the UK intelligence services, which is obviously very relevant when you come to try to unravel the strange circumstances of the Manchester Arena bombing. Crazy stuff, right? But I can guarantee you one thing. The jury at the Old Bailey in London will not hear anything about MI6 and Ramadan Abedi and Libya. Not a damn thing. Terrorism is everywhere today. In the news, 20 jihadis are on the loose, apparently. The tabloid newspaper's rolling this out this morning. 20 jihadis are out there that had been released early, having served half their sentences, and more are on the way out. It's a bit like Agent Smith in Matrix Reloaded. Do you remember in Matrix Reloaded when Neo keeps fighting off Agent Smith, and then millions of Agent Smiths run onto the basketball court? I think they're on a basketball court. Agent Smith's coming out of everywhere. So a lot of jihadis on the loose, millions of them. Here's a question for you, dear listener. Answers on a postcard, please. The Richie Allen Show, Towers, Salford. Believe me, the postman knows where it is. Richie Allen Show, Towers, Salford. It'll get to me. It's like sending a letter to Santa Claus. It's guaranteed to come down my chimney. What the feck do you do with jihadis? Jihadi daddies like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the jihadi daddy. And a fine jihadi daddy was he. What do you do with them? So you send them into prison because they've been on Tinternet and they've been looking at beheading videos. Hayden Hewitt's fault of that. Nobody in the world ever knew anything about beheading videos. Hayden Hewitt started putting them on the internet. Yeah. He didn't, actually. But funnily enough, as you know, a lie travels twice around the world before the truth has time to put its underpants on. Or its trousers. Hayden is not responsible for it. But to the BBC and to Sky News, Hayden is known as the beheading man. Anyway, what do you do with these guys? They digest terrorist material. They download stuff. They read stuff. They have their little meetings. They go to the mosque and afterwards they have their tea. And they get their hookah pipe out. And they plot terrorism. What do you do with them? Right? What do you do with them? Do you hang them? Do you put them in the electric chair? Do you send them to an uninhabited island in the South Pacific? Do you? Well, you won't believe who has the answer. Nana Akua has the answer. Not Nana Muscuri. It's the first thing I thought when I read Nana Akua. Nana Muscuri, I don't even know if she's still alive. Jesus, she was lovely, wasn't she? Nana Muscuri back in the day, eh? Oh, be Jesus. Anyway, Nana Akua is Lady Excise on Twitter. She's known as Lady Excise. She's a fitness guru, apparently. And she was on Jeremy Vine's television show this morning, which I think is on Channel 5. Lady Excise doesn't know the first thing about... Well, I tell you what, I'm being very judgmental there, maybe. Maybe she does know a lot about geopolitics. But she doesn't come across as though she does. She's a fitness guru. Lady Excise. She was on the panel. What shall we do with the jihadi daddies? What shall we do with the jihadi daddies? Early in the morning, this is what she says. I think she's bang on.
Perhaps what would be good would be even be a lie detector test. And if they fail that, then I think potentially you've got the option for a full frontal lobotomy. Potentially.
Really? Or go in with an ice pick?
I think that ultimately, if
they did, I mean, back in the day, that's what they did.
That's what they did.
Yeah, but that might attract the attention of some lawyers.
No, I'm perfectly serious. Look, if you've gone through all the procedures, this person is beyond any help with this so-called high course that doesn't appear to de-radicalise anybody, and then that still doesn't work. They've done the lie detector test and that hasn't worked, and they are still a serious risk to the public. I mean, this guy has been followed by two police officers.
15, apparently.
Well, exactly. And how much does that cost?
Yeah. So, but this does involve, just for those who don't know, driving a steel needle behind the eyes to detach two bits of the brain.
Well, that's right. And what it does.
You do that.
Yeah. Lobotomize them, says Nana Akua. Just lobotomize them. If they don't repent, if they're failing the lie detector tests, just give them a full frontal lobotomy. Guess who else was on the panel? You won't believe it. Only Owen Jones, the virtue-signalling little bollocks himself. Jones was on there and, well, he couldn't resist talking about himself.
Yeah, I mean, what terrorists want us to do is they want to change our society. They want us to become brutal human rights abusers. And I interviewed a survivor of the Breivik Norway terrorist attack. And there they played it by the book. He's actually in a prison which here would be portrayed as luxurious and all the rest of it. And I said to the victim, didn't that make you angry? And he said, no, because I didn't want him to change who we were. You know, I didn't want justice to be perverted because that would martyr him.
Would you be in favour of that?
Absolutely not, because if somebody is still radicalised or spouting whatever kind of beliefs, false beliefs, then they've probably got a mental health issue. And why should that be treated by stabbing them in the brain?
Well, no, actually...
That's absolutely brutal.
No, it's not.
Changing their personality and changing their behaviours by mechanical
don't
means.
Really. No, hang on, let me be honest with you. No, seriously. I mean, honestly. I mean, what... You've talked about mental health and such, but they use these kind of things to help with schizophrenia and mental health conditions, actually. So ultimately, I think that if somebody
That's
is...
selectively done,
ultimately, if somebody is unable to change their way of thinking, which is a danger to the public, and only one of these terrorists could actually create mass destruction, right, then I would say that lobotomising them could be a good idea.
Lobotomise them, why not, eh? Got a bit of Owen Jones there before that. 22 minutes past the hour. Tuesday's programme. Getting ahead of myself there. Tuesday's radio programme. Welcome to it, by the way. Thanks for your tweets. Hi to Mike. Hi to David. How you doing, David? Hi to Busy as well. Oh, God, loads and loads. Hi to Susan. To John. John says he was very disappointed that the Commodore Fishmongers Hall Commodore didn't give us any commentary on the Streatham incident. Yes. Remember the Commodore and the Ballad of Lucas? The Polish glasswasher? Great stuff that, wasn't it? I'd have based Ninja to Mwinga, who says Pretty sounds like she's the best fit in the Johnson government. Yeah, very good. Hi to Laurie Hatfield, how are you doing, Laurie? Listening in stateside this afternoon. Hi to Faisal as well. To David, otherwise known as Cartoon Drunk. And to Mark, I'll tell you what we'll do now. We'll have a tune and then we'll go a different way. We'll get away from terrorism entirely, because I think you might be a bit tired of terrorism and jihadi daddies and all the rest of it. And I am as well. This is music from the Smashing Pumpkins. I've not heard this for ages. A song called 1979. I'll be back with more. Keep those tweets coming in. Don't forget, brilliant guest in the second hour of the programme. Smashing Pumpkins on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Terrific tune, 1979. 27 minutes past five. Welcome if you've just joined the programme. Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer joins me in around about a half an hour's time. Can't wait for that. Lots to talk about with her. The coronavirus, the HIV virus. We're going to talk about World Cancer Day, which is today. And a distressing, well, I say distressing, I don't want to come off as being one of those, you know. But I was, I suppose, at one time, a big fan of the actress Shannon Doherty. I say was. I was, I don't know if I should admit this. I was a big fan of that TV show, Beverly Hills 90210, I think it's called, when I was in my teens. And I liked Shannon Doherty. And I had an amazing thing. I've not met very many people in terms of show business people. Most of the people I've met over the years that are well known would be political figures or sporting figures. Met a lot of well-known sporting figures. Not too many show-busy people. A few, but not too many. But she was one of the ones I met. And I met her in Ireland many, many years ago. It's a lovely story about my meeting her. I'm not going to tell it now. Really interesting story. And she was lovely. She was a really lovely person. And she's battling stage 4 cancer. She's had cancer for a couple of years, or a few years. And she's had chemo and all the various radiotherapies, I believe. And I think it's come back really aggressively. And she's in a bit of a bad way. I don't know her personally, apart from having met her. But I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about cancer as well with Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer in the second hour of the programme. We'll also talk about cancer tomorrow. We'll take a different perspective on it with a guest whom I was supposed to speak with yesterday, but because of the late cry-off yesterday, I didn't get to do it. Charles Pixley will be on the radio show tomorrow. And again, you're not going to want to miss that. Okay. David watched Charmed, which Shannon was in as well. That's right, she was indeed. Hi to Matt. Matt underscore scientist. How you doing, Matt? Right. Let's quickly move on, because there are a few things we need to get through before we speak with our guest. Big row today. Mentioned on the live stream nonsense on YouTube. There was a press briefing scheduled at Downing Street yesterday. And the briefing was to be given by the man, a civil servant, by the way, who will lead the UK in the trade negotiations with the European Union in the coming months. So the press were going to be briefed on what the UK positions would be heading in. And several newspapers were not invited to the briefing and were subsequently refused admittance. They were refused entry. So, to their credit, the BBC and ITV representatives, Laura Koonsberg and Robert Peston, respectively, and others, walked out in solidarity with their colleagues. As I said, talked a little bit about it this morning. It isn't good. Again, it isn't good. I don't care how pathetic the UK press is. When you have politicians, particularly government politicians, ministers or civil servants working for the government, telling certain journalists they're not allowed in the room, it's dreadful. Won't repeat myself. Live streamed this morning. I talked about it at length. I tried to explain it, because I know that many of you, many of my listeners, are far more intelligent than me. But these are things you don't consider because you don't. This is not your gig. It's not your job. You look at the BBC, The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Mail, The Mirror, and you pour scorn on them. And you're right. But it doesn't mean it's okay for baby Trump, that Muppet in number 10, to emulate his counterpart in the United States by excluding journalists from asking questions. It's shocking. Now, Labour's Chris Bryant and the Conservative Party's Gillian Keegan, both MPs, were on the BBC Politics show at lunchtime. You will hear Chris Bryant before you hear Gillian Keegan. Chris Bryant isn't impressed at all.
Honestly, it's the first thing that an authoritarian government does on its road to authoritarianism, which is it starts to decide who gets to hear the message and who gets excluded. Neville Chamberlain did it in 1937, 1938, 1939, and look where that ended up with. And I fear that Boris Johnson's team are a set of people who do not like scrutiny. They really dislike it, and they will do everything in their power to make sure that there isn't proper scrutiny of their work. This was a civil servant. So it wasn't a special advisor or something like that. No. It was the person in charge of the Brexit negotiations, and that should have been available to the whole of the lobby. There's a parliamentary element to this as well, because the lobby is a parliamentary concept.
Right. Authoritarian government, first step.
I there is no way that we're an authoritarian government. All that
Why not let everybody
in this
in?
Country, we would have an authoritarian government. And in terms of scrutiny, we are highly scrutinised at all levels of all governance in this country. So
Andrew
I think
Neil. Now,
I think
was,
we should, yeah. Well, Andrew yeah, he, yeah, he didn't yeah. turn up. He didn't want to be interviewed by. We have a right, or we have freedom of choice.
Nobody
as well.
Going on the Today programme.
It's important that the government has a constructive relationship with the media, and I'm sure that will get there.
The Today programme? Why is nobody going on the Today programme?
I've never been asked. If they want to ask me, I'll go on. I've been an
There you go. Gillian's eager to go on the Today programme. But on here.
They probably want someone more important, right? They want someone more important. But, he was there in Greenwich yesterday. All the journalists were there. He spent, a long time answering questions. There is no way you can avoid scrutiny in this country. You can't move for politicians on the television and the radio, us two included right now. So, I don't think this is... I mean, clearly there is some relationship, sort of difficulties at the moment, but I'm sure that...
Well, do you agree with medium what they term, did?
It's not something I would do. I would go on and speak to anyone. But I'm a very open person. I'm very happy to do that. So that's not my style. But I could be naive as well. I'm not putting in for it.
Yeah, and we've talked, and Brian brought it up on Sky News the other morning with Kay Burley. More and more, you'll see more and more as time goes on, they call themselves public servants, elected officials, will, as time goes on, be less inclined to appear on television and radio programmes, where they might be scrutinised. They're very rarely scrutinised, very rarely, but even though that is the case, they will be more inclined in the future to do all their talking through their social media channels. And that's no good at all. Okay? Making their podcasts. Number of MPs these days have a podcast where they get to, pontificate and proselytize to whomever downloads it, but without facing any questions or any challenges to the things they're saying. And again, I think this bothers me far more than it bothers you, and it should really bother you. But I'm going to leave that just for now. 24 and a half minutes to 6, Tuesday's programme, February 4th. Let's stay with journalism. We're going to hear a couple of examples of presenting now, some very, very good presenting and some very bad presenting on two different issues. Let's stay with number 10's briefing, which banned certain newspapers and journalists. Emma Barnett, or Barnett, if you please, I don't know which one it is, presents for BBC Radio 5 Live. And today, she interviewed Sir Craig Oliver, who's a former number 10 director of communications. Understandable why you'd want to have him on. Because you want to get to the bottom of why the government is excluding certain journalists. So Barnett interviews Sir Craig Oliver, former director of communications, and this is wretched. You'll remember the other morning on the live stream nonsense, I talked at length about presenters today, about how the programmes are all about them, how the programme is a prop to support their celebrity, and how guests are nothing more than props to showcase the celebrity presenter showing off. Listen to this nonsense from Emma Barnett with Craig Oliver on BBC Radio 5 Live this morning.
Some of the briefings that I've read have suggested that a certain group of journalists were invited and others turned up. I'm not sure who's telling the truth in this one, but it just seems to me to be a little more confused and complicated than people are saying. My personal view is, look, both sides need to step back. Both sides need to step back, have a look at this and say, hold on a minute, is this what we really want? The Streatham terror attack at the weekend resulted in no government ministers really going out and doing broadcasts. I think that isn't a great thing. It's not a great situation to get yourself in where there is a terrorist attack in the country. Whose fault is that? Well, I mean, look, obviously it's up to the government to decide whether or not they're going to put people up. I do think that there is a flip side to this.
People don't know what that phrase means.
Barnett
is interrupting Craig Oliver for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Barnett is about to make the claim that the listener is as thick as pig shit. And anybody who's ever been around a farm, and I've been around a few, will know that pig excrement is pretty thick. Barnett, being a petty, petulant, grandstanding little princess, decides to stop Craig Oliver to ask him to explain what he means when he says the government will put people up, because you and me were too thick to understand. This is presenting in 2020. Writ large, right? Listen to this.
Why do you have to interrupt?
Put people up could mean all sorts of things outside of the world of journalism and politics.
Emma, come on, it's pretty obvious. If you're saying put people up, it means...
Indeed it is.
...put people up, it means put them for interview. But if you want to explain them and interrupt me to make that point, that's absolutely fine.
You are a former member of the BBC, and you have been around countless tables that I've been around to say, please explain phrases when you say them. But yes, do carry on.
Bit pedantic there. Everybody knows what he meant when he said the government put people up. It means put people up. It means put people out there. It means put people into radio studios for interviews. Anyway, strike one there.
I'm sorry, this interview appears to be going in a very strange direction, Emma. I'm trying to explain to you that, look, this is a bit more complicated than you might think. And also, actually, as an impartial journalist who's trying to help people understand it, you might also explain that there is a different side to this in terms of why governments operate the way they do in terms of journalists. Is that too far or not? I'm simply trying to say to you, this is probably a more complicated situation than you are allowing it to or representing it as.
And Barnett is so self-obsessed, so narcissistic, so concerned about herself and how she comes across. Because these days, radio isn't radio anymore. All of this stuff is filmed. And it's on the BBC 5 Twitter feed. It's on bbc.co.uk. It's television as much as it is radio in 2020. So concerned with Barnett. Is Barnett about herself and how she's coming across? Trying to be tough for no reason whatsoever, that Barnett is missing a vital opportunity here, which is to say to Craig Oliver, listen, hang on a second, Craig. Let's cut through the waffle. They turned journalists away from a briefing at number 10 yesterday, from the Mirror and from the Eye paper and from the Huffington Post. Now, Craig, these are publications that have been very critical of Boris Johnson, particularly in the past. And two of them have supported the Labour Party, well, since forever. Isn't that the reason? And isn't that not a good thing, Craig? You know, that's what it should be about. But no, Barnett has to grandstand.
Presenting it as, and it's very easy to stand up and shout about defences of freedom and whatever, when actually I suspect what happened in Downing Street is slightly more complicated.
Did you hear the... Am I concerned? Could I just come in at this point? Did you hear my introduction?
to me or to
the whole item at 10:07?
No.
Okay.
No.
So perhaps go back and listen to that, and you will have heard my Downing Street side of this, the Downing Street putting forward their side of this. You will have heard Michael Gove. You will have heard those sides of this. So as an impartial journalist, yes, I have put forward that side of it. I have also put forward, and we will be hearing from a former member of the lobby coming up very shortly. But my question, could I ask you a question?
Could if you didn't actually give me a lecture before you did. I thought you were trying to interview.
Sorry, I was just responding to your lecture about my impartiality. But my question is this. When you say there is no minister available or being put up to go for an interview at the weekend, which was a very serious news incident, as you rightly point out, whose fault is that? That's what I'm trying to understand. Is that the fault of a relationship that's broken down already between Number 10 and journalists?
It is a relationship that has broken down. And what I am trying to say is, look, what it is incumbent on everybody to do is probably take a breath, including you, by the way, and take a breath and stand back and have a look at this and say, look, how do we get to a situation where we're not spending acres of time on Radio 5 Live navel-gazing about journalists and talking to politicians and not on whatever, and actually addressing the issues that some of your audience are probably like slightly more interested in. That means that it is incumbent on both sides, politicians and journalists, to take a breath, step back, say, look, how do we sort this out?
Wow, I'm breathing just fine. And we were very grateful for you to give us your time. And I'm sorry you feel it was navel-gazing and is boring to our listeners who are texting in their droves. Sir Greg Oliver, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Yeah, the virtue-signalling, wretched, worst journalist in the history of the UK, Emma Barnett there, allowed it to descend into some sort of commentary about the attack on Sunday and why there weren't journalists available. Why there weren't politicians available on Sunday to speak in the immediate aftermath of this attack in Streatham, when really the whole point of the interview and the reason why Oliver was invited on was to discuss why journalists were banned from joining in the civil servants' briefing on the Brexit negotiations. It's as simple as that. That's a serious issue. And it descends into just nothing when you got people like Emma Barnett. Let's hear it done properly, right? Julia Hartley Brewer presents for Talk Radio. Used to present for LBC. Very good. We're going from the ridiculous to the sublime here. She's interviewing Michael Gove, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. And Michael Gove also, these days, is a minister, or the minister, for no-deal Brexit planning. Right? Doesn't mean he's the minister for no-deal. He's the minister for planning for a possible no-deal as the negotiations unfold or manifest in the coming 11 months or whatever. Now, the government announced today that it's bringing forward plans to ban diesel, the sale of diesel and petrol cars, from 2040 back to 2035. So 15 years. You won't be able to buy a diesel or a petrol car. You also won't be able to buy a hybrid car. Dreadful. There's a million things wrong with it, but I don't have time to get into it right now, and I've said it before 1,000 times anyway. Julia Hartley Brewer, as a proper journalist and a really good presenter, who doesn't grandstand, doesn't virtue signal, doesn't use guests as her props, wanted Michael Gove to explain, if you ban the sale of diesel, petrol cars and hybrid cars, how much is this going to cost the taxpayer? Namely, dear listener, me and you. This is an example of how it should be done. Good stuff. This is a teaching manual. Julia Hartley Brewer.
Okay, but I do want to come on to some criticism of Boris Johnson in this role at the moment. But a lot of people will be concerned that it's all very well, it all sounds very good, but we are talking about a major change to the infrastructure of our cities, our towns, our roads. I mean, I live in a flat at the back of the house. Nowhere I can charge my vehicle. Are we going to have charging points everywhere along the road? And who on earth is going to pay for that other than taxpayers? And how much is it going to cost us?
Yes, we will have more charging points. Two, it will be paid for because, essentially electricity, like any form of fuel, power or energy, is something that we all have to pay for.
No, and who's going to pay for the infrastructure? We are talking about billions upon billions and billions of pounds. It's going to come out of taxes. We're going to have to raise our taxes to do this, aren't we?
Well, there are it's already the case that in order to make sure that we effectively pay for both our road infrastructure and for the environment, that people are taxed by the duty on petrol and on diesel. People are taxed through their road taxes, like the license for any car. It is the case that we need to make sure that we have a more rational approach towards supporting transport and electric vehicles, and the appropriate infrastructure will ensure that energy is cheaper, cleaner and safer.
Okay, so we're going to go all electric in 15 years' time, pretty much.
Yep.
What's the cost of that? I've asked you a couple of times, because this is a major policy change. A lot of people who still have older cars, people can't move away from a diesel car or a hybrid car to an electric car unless they've got somewhere to charge it. And most people probably got like maybe one, maybe at the end of their road. This is going to cost a lot of money to put their infrastructure in. And I mean, we are, again, in the tens and tens of billions. How much is it going to cost, and what are our taxes going to go up by?
This is excellent stuff by Julia Hartley Brewer. Gove is giving long-winded non-answers. Rather than constantly jump down his throat or try to score points off of Gove and impress our audience with how hard she is, because Julia Hartley Brewer is only interested in Michael Gove, she's not aware of the listening audience. She's doing her job and won't let him off the hook. And this is how it should be done. Without interrupting every 4 seconds and shouting at people. This is excellent. This is a rigorous examination of a government minister who doesn't have the answer. She's not letting him off the hook.
Tax is going to go up by. Because if you're not charging money for diesel and petrol vehicles anymore, and for those, you're going to be charging it somewhere else. So how much is it going to cost us?
The key thing, and I can't put a figure on this.
So wait a minute, are you telling me we've got a government policy announcement that's been uncosted?
No.
This is very Corbynista, isn't it?
No. The point I'd make is that over a 15-year period, we're going to phase out a particular type of vehicle and introduce another. It's already the case that we have charging points in every new development, and they're going to become mainstream as a result.
And who's going to pay for it?
In some cases, it will be the developers who are responsible for those developments. And
well,
in some cases,
I don't live in, I like most people, don't live in a new street. I live in a street that's been there since 1880. So who's going to pay to have a charging point outside every single home?
This is outstanding stuff, this. This is how it used to be back in the day. Again, I can only speak for Ireland. Some of the greatest broadcasters of all time came from my country. The recently departed Marion Finucane, Gay Byrne. This is brilliant. Listen, stop with your nonsense about developments. We don't live in new developments. Who the fuck is going to pay for the infrastructure needed to get us all into electric cars from the middle part of the next decade, Mr. Gove? And the normally unflappable Michael Gove, who used to be a journalist himself, and to be fair to him, is pretty excellent when it comes to, you know, dealing with interviews, giving non-answers, political speak. Gove is brilliant. The only time I've ever seen Gove flapping was when Faisal Islam interviewed him on Sky just before the referendum in 2016. She's got Gove on the run here.
Home in my street and all the streets of people who are listening right now.
I suspect there will be charging points in what used to be, or what will have used,
I suspect,
used to have been the petrol station where you would currently get your petrol and diesel.
I haven't got a petrol station within a mile or two of my home. Am I going to get my car there if I haven't got any charge in it?
Well, it will.
And how long will it take me to charge up my electric vehicle? I'm just going to have to leave it there for overnight. How many cars in my area do you think can go to the local petrol station and get charged up?
As many as go there to get petrol at the moment. Yes, as many as currently go there to get petrol.
Right? No, just no answers. Where you used to get petrol in your neighbourhood, we'll have the charging points there. But there isn't any petrol station anywhere near me, says Julia Hartley Brewer. Funnily enough, the nearest petrol station to me is exactly 2 miles away. Anyway, there's a bit more of this.
I have a horrible feeling that this is policy that's being made on the hoof that's going to cost the British taxpayer billions and billions and billions of pounds.
Policy made on the hoof that's going to cost the taxpayer billions and billions and billions and billions of pounds. She's right. I wonder, does Julia Hartley Brewer lie awake at night and wonder, what else is it about? Because it isn't just about saving the planet and taxing the bejesus out of people. Maybe it's about preventing people from travelling, maybe. Maybe it's about keeping people where they are, making it more difficult for them to be independent. and to travel independently. I wonder, does it ever occur to her? Maybe it does. Anyway.
And no one's actually thought it through because we're all making lovely gesture politics.
No, I don't think it's the case that you would have companies like Nissan or Tesla investing in electric technology for vehicles if they thought that this was just a...
That's his answer. His answer is, no, it's okay because Tesla and Nissan, well, they're not stupid, Julia. They wouldn't invest in this technology unless they had a plan. Right.
No,
a whimsy.
I don't think it's a whimsy. I'm just simply saying that the move towards all electric vehicles is going to cost the taxpayer money, and no one seems to be talking about that. By all means, let's move to electric vehicles, but who's gonna pay for the infrastructure to allow us to move to electric vehicles?
That's the 12th time she's asked them that, and she doesn't have to be Jeremy Paxman either.
And I've got no answer.
Ultimately, these things will be decided by an interplay of market forces
But you've decided...
Ultimately, they'll be decided by an interplay of market forces and fuck, I can't think on my feet here. In other words, we've given no thought to it about how it's going to be paid for. Billions, as she said, putting charging points, dozens of them, on every street in the country. And how are those going to be powered? Right? This is brilliant by Julia Hartley Brewer today.
Did the policy without finding out what the cost would be? And who?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Who'd pay for it?
Julia, I don't think you could tell me what the cost of petrol is going to be in 50 months' time, let alone 15 years' time.
It's going to be cheaper than putting an electric charging point outside every home in the country. I'll tell you that.
Very good stuff. Julia Hartley Brewer on Talk Radio this morning, putting Michael Gove through the ringer. And saying to him, let's be honest, pal, this is gesture politics. You're pandering to the environmental evangelical lunatics and you're saying we'll stop the sale of diesel and petrol cars in 2035 and you haven't given a single thought to how much money that is going to cost. That's how you expose people. Without grandstanding, without trying to embarrass people, without showing off, without looking at Twitter all the time to see how many praising tweets you're getting for your brilliance. Just ask him the question. Let him hang himself. Let him hoist himself on his own petard. Excellent stuff there. 7 minutes to the top of the hour. We'll hear from Gove again in a minute about something else. Extinction Rebellion and Summer 2020. We'll hear about that in a minute. Very good. Another example of how bad it is in the UK today. It's a little bit of a lecture today on the conduct of UK television presenters, the very top presenters. Here's another example of... I mean, I shouldn't have said Emma Barnett's the worst in the country. She isn't. Piers Morgan is the worst in the country. The very worst. Dreadful. He makes Emma Barnett sound like Johnny Carson. Morgan on GMB this morning had a PETA woman on. That's People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. PETA. And I have some sympathy with PETA. I really do. I think some of the things they come out with are a bit strange and a bit silly, but I've got sympathy with those who look out for the rights of animals. Of course I do. One of the things PETA wants to do, bizarrely, is change the language that we use to describe animals. For example, not to refer to them as pets anymore, because pets implies ownership. Now this is a bit silly, and for some reason GMB, Good Morning Britain, thought it was a bit of a slow news day. But this amplifies what I've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. Piers Morgan is dreadful. He's got a young woman on from PETA called Jennifer White. She's not an asshole. She's not a bad person. She's not a bad woman. She might be a bit misplaced or misguided in terms of what she's trying to do. But let her speak, man. Let her speak.
No, the dogs don't care. But a lot of people at home who have dogs and cats, they will call these animals their pets and they'll refer to themselves as owners. And this implies that the animals are a possession. Like a car,
for God's sake. No.
5 seconds into the answer, he starts jumping at her.
No, you don't even believe this, Gav, do you?
I do. Because when you refer to animals, not as the living beings that they are, but as an inanimate object, it can reflect our treatment on these animals.
But hang on a moment. Under the law, they're possessions, aren't they?
Well, animals are their own individual beings. So then, you know, when we see people who they get dogs, you know, for Christmas, for example, and then by the 1st of January, these dogs are already going into shelters because the novelties.
But that's not about their name. It's about the education. And I think PETA,
that's about bad ownership.
And I think your organisation, my issue with it, is that you are known for doing some great activism. And now you're trivialising all the work you've done by basically just trying to change a name. I am an owner because I bought my dog and I own it. Own it, if you look in America, especially with people like Michelle Obama, Oprah Winfrey, they talk about ownership as having some kind of care for something and taking responsibility. I have responsibility for my dog.
Ownership is actually a good thing.
I think it's a very good thing.
Let's cut to some of the other phrases you want to get rid of. Bring home the bacon. You want to say?
Bring home the bagels.
Bring home the bacon.
Yeah. But what happens if you like actually want to bring home bacon? Yeah.
What if you like bacon? And don't like bagels.
These are, you know, these are playful expressions that are inclusive for everyone. And
take the bull by the horns. What do you want to make that?
Well, that one we just don't want to use. There's no need.
No, it says here you want to say take the flower.
Yeah, don't let her answer any question you ask her. Morgan is basically a poor man's Bill O'Reilly. And again, this is where the UK media is going in 2020. Right, 3.5 minutes to the top of the hour. That's been a quick hour, that. It was for me, anyway. I might be boring to be Jesus out of you, for all I know. But it's been a quick hour for me. Just before we wrap up the hour and move on and speak to our guest who's in Canada, let's hear again from Michael Gove. Now, I mentioned either this morning or maybe yesterday morning, LBC Radio is going to run a campaign through the Nick Ferrari Breakfast Programme to try and get the police to deal with Extinction Rebellion protesters. Not to stop them protesting, but to prevent them impeding people going about their business. This was a huge problem last year, right? Extinction Rebellion people were thrown into jail for a couple of hours. They were left out and they went back to London again and blocked up roads and streets and everything else. Egypts. Nick Ferrari had Michael Gove on to ask Gove, would the government do something about this, plan for it, again, to stop these protesters without infringing upon their human right to protest? Can you equally allow them protest, but also stop them from preventing me and you and everybody else going about our business? Michael Gove with Nick Ferrari.
Well, I think it's appropriate to balance two things. I have to apologise to you, Nick. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a greenie, and I do have a lot of sympathy with the Extinction Rebellion protesters' aims.
Yes.
But their tactics, are counterproductive, and I think that Cresta Dick, who's a great police officer, and the Met, need to have all the appropriate tools in order to make sure that people can get to work, that the life of London can carry on. I've got no problem with legitimate protest and so on, and people making their views heard, but there comes a point where it does teeter over into disrupting other people's lives in a way that I think is wrong. So in that sense, I think it's appropriate to back the police up.
And so you would be interested in reviewing those laws that would allow the human rights of the protesters to protest be balanced with the human rights of people who want to go and get put in a day shift at work?
I'm always open to making sure that the right balance is struck, absolutely. I think it's really important that people should have the right to protest, and I wouldn't want to be heavy-handed about it, but I think it's also right that if you do have a level of disruption that becomes, a total pain for people who are simply trying to get to work or to help others, then we will need to reassess exactly where the balance lies.
It's going to be an interesting year, this, once the weather improves, when these loonies are out on the streets again, gluing themselves to the streets and trying to block access to buildings and all the rest of it. It's a difficult one for me, because I believe that every human being has the absolute right to assemble and to protest. Of course I do. Why is it difficult? It's difficult for me because I know that however well-meaning many of these Extinction Rebellion activists are, they're completely and utterly wrong. The world is not facing cataclysmic weather shifts and disasters because of man-made CO2. It isn't. It's a nonsense. You know, so given, I suppose if I was left to my own devices, they wouldn't be allowed to protest at all. But no, I don't mean that. Everybody has the right to assemble. It'll be interesting to see what happens this year, because they're planning bigger and more disruptive protests around the country. It won't just be London, of course. It'll be Birmingham. It'll be Manchester. It'll be Glasgow, Edinburgh, Cardiff, of course, Belfast, Ballyhackley, Port Lauderdale, maybe. Who the hell knows? I've got to get some oil for my chair. It's very squeaky today. I haven't noticed that before. It's 6 o'clock. Well, it's a minute past six. It is February 4th, 2020. Over to FSN for headlines.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Benji Hire. Results from voting in Iowa have been plunged into chaos by technology issues. The caucus there acts as the first round in the contest to pick a Democrat candidate to face US President Donald Trump. Hong Kong has confirmed its first death from coronavirus, marking the second death outside of mainland China since the outbreak. And this will be the defining year of climate action for the planet, claims UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
Yeah, Boris Johnson standing alongside none other than David Attenborough, the BBC's climate change man. Right, this is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. I'll be back in a second. Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer will join me as well. You don't want to miss her.
Renowned healer Mark Bayerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bayerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbayerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Music from the Corrs on the Richie Allen Radio Show. 7 minutes past six. It is Salford in Greater Manchester. Rush hour. Just heard from Phil driving in rush hour traffic there on Liverpool Street. You don't want to be on Liverpool Street at this time of the day, Phil. You also don't want to be caught using your mobile phone, Phil, in your car, Phil, because you might get arrested, Phil. So be very careful. Listen, this is serious, this coronavirus. Well, when we say it's serious, we're very sceptical at the Richie Allen Radio Show. Of course we are. The UK government today said, look, they said, if you're in China, get out of the country. Get out because we need to minimise the risk of exposure to this virus. According to the World Health Organization, at least 427 people have died having contracted this virus. And there have been more than 20,000 confirmed cases, most of them in China. You might know, you might not know, that British people returning to the UK from China have been scooped up by military people. This is no joke, by the way. And they have been brought to the Wirral, Merseyside, where they are put in quarantine for at least 2 weeks. I'm a bit sceptical about this. Well, I might be. And I'm delighted to welcome to the programme. Can't believe we haven't spoken to her before. She is a doctor of naturopathic medicine, getting her diploma from the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine about 10 or so years ago. Long time interest she's had in botanical medicine, in self-education on this topic, which is hugely interesting in this day and age, of course. And she has got a website which is packed full of fascinating information called Yummy Mummy Emporium, emporium.org, yummymummyemporium.org. I will tweet links out to that so you can get on there and check her out. She's currently writing a book on dimethyl sulfoxide that's going to be out in a couple of months' time. Let's welcome to the programme Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer. Amanda, it's a pleasure to meet you. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate that.
Now, you're very kind to come on. We didn't give you a lot of notice, but this is a massive story, this. And you've been writing about this on your Facebook page. You've got a huge following on there, as your website does as well. And you believe that the coronavirus scare is another hoax. I'm reading verbatim now from your Facebook page. Another hoax perpetrated upon us or you. Viruses don't cause diseases. Remember the last coronavirus scam called SARS? It's about instilling fear in a population and manipulating them into accepting new funding and regulations. Now, we'll talk about the manipulation because I'm fascinated by it. Tell us about viruses not causing diseases. Can you explain that for me?
Sure. Well, it is quite a large topic. I'll try to summarize it for you. What's important to understand, though, is that at the time of where we were looking at microorganisms and trying to identify the causes of disease, there was about a 40-year debate happening around the time of Louis Pasteur and Antoine Béchamp between these doctors, what was the cause? And it was split between germs as causation versus the terrain being in an imbalanced state as causing illness in the body. And this debate went on and on for, like I said, 40 years. Obviously, the science wasn't settled. And what won out, of course, was politics, because it is much easier, they found, to manipulate populations by fear-mongering and telling them that there's something that they can catch in the air that they cannot see, that they cannot identify, they don't have proper machinery, microscopes, knowledge to identify. So they have to just believe what they're told to believe. And it was an excellent use of not only manipulating wars, pushing populations, pushing through new laws, but also to remove culpability from the perpetrators of the actual illness, which is toxins, pollutions, metals, burning garbage, for example, what's happening in China. They're protesting. Governments don't want protesters. Governments don't want trouble. They just want obedient slave class that does their bidding for them. And when there's trouble afoot, like has been going on in Wuhan, China, with protests against more incinerators, which is burning garbage and throwing it into their air, causing severe respiratory illnesses, as well as the 5G issue that they've been heavily protesting, what can you do to quiet them? Well, like they've done year after year after year. Last year it was just regular flu, then you had Ebola, then you had SARS, and you can see the patterns that have emerged. If you have a clear mind and you can think logically and you can look into the history of this game that they've been playing to, again, shut people up and manipulate them into taking their poison vaccines, which is the real population control. And that's when you really start to see illness flourishing even further, because the issue is that toxins cause disease, not bugs per se. You have a resultant activity in the body, in the terrain, when you are sick. Yes, your own microbes go into action to remove the offending material, whatever it may be. And not only that, but it helps cellular turnover, absorption of vitamins, even creation of vitamins. And then they're pushed out of the body through all the routes of elimination. That's when you start to see symptoms. So, for example, if you look at what they call the flu, what's happening here is you have toxins trying to be removed through the lung tissue. The lung tissue has been damaged, okay? It's been damaged by, in this case, in Wuhan, air pollution. Oftentimes, I will see in my practice people who have the flu or anything chest-related, their livers are already fully congested, so the liver is not working to remove toxins appropriately. Their kidneys are also backlogged, so those aren't working to filter properly. They might even have rashes, which is toxins being pushed out through the skin, as we see in what they're calling measles, which is really, again, just a detoxification of a damaged terrain, sure, you're going to get particulates of your own microbes being seen in exudates and in tissue and in the, you know, phlegm and mucus that will be produced naturally to remove these pollutants. But it's the mistake of saying that the effect is the cause. So just because you see a bacterium in an exudate or a phlegm, let's say, doesn't mean that they have caused it. It's akin to saying that you've produced garbage and you've put it at the side of your house and then all the flies start coming. It's akin to saying the flies cause the garbage. It's ridiculous. And it's just not how disease actually works. But they bank on you not knowing that, on you not knowing the history of how the lie was born and how it has been perpetuated and created, even with sophisticated so-called testing, looking like you've got something when they do that. If you look at Dr. Stefan Lenka for a really good source of this, he is an authority upon what is actually going on with like HIV testing and influenza testing and how that little magic trick is set up. And that's really good information that I encourage everyone to investigate themselves.
This is good because John Rappaport, who's a health journalist I have a lot of time for, I've known him for many years, endorses your conclusion as to what's really gone on in Wuhan there. And what you've described there, Amanda, is a bit of a wag the dog situation, isn't it? I mean, for those of our listeners who don't remember the film Wag the Dog, a great political, satirical comedy film, the president is facing a sex scandal. I know, let's have a war with Albania. That'll distract from the fact that I've been caught with my trousers down, as it were. And John said that the same thing. He said, you know, it's not been reported widely that the incinerator situation in Wuhan, that the air pollution in Wuhan, that other things going on there, might very well be the reason why people are expressing respiratory issues or respiratory problems there. And like yourself, he reckons that's been seized upon to create a big scare. And then John links it then to the fact that in the future, well, in the very near future, there might be a vaccine. And you also have a bit of sympathy, don't you, Amanda, with the notion, I mean, you talk about this, you've been writing about this extensively in recent days and on Twitter, that we've seen this time and again in recent years with the SARS scare, with the Zika virus scare in Latin America, with swine flu, and nothing really ever came of any of those scares. And I wonder, what's happened to people that they don't stop and think, hang on a second, I've seen this one before, you know. I do remember a few years ago they told us we were all going to die from swine flu, and yet here we are. So you're very much... you want to remind people, don't you, that this is not new. We've been here before.
Correct. And you've labeled it nicely. You've described it nicely. And it's if you can piece it together in your mind, you can see the pattern. And if you understand patterns and you really can figure out a lot about this world, you can figure a lot about health. Studying patterns has really helped me work through myth and work through conjecture and work through, you know, the naive sense that we have, because I really feel that we are, if you're a loving human and you're a human who cares about others, there's an underpinning gullibility that can come alongside of that. And we have to overcome the gullibility part or the naive part of ourselves and look at really the facts very straightforwardly without, you know, plating on any emotion. Emotion, we tend to be manipulated emotionally, and it's about having strong emotional IQs in this particular political era and really having the facts with us, because here we have so much available to us through the internet. I mean, it's really unprecedented the amount of information that we have access to, but we're continually distracted with it. And it's ironic that we seem to be actually descending into ignorance rather than using this to awaken and to really figure out the problem, reaction, solution, Hegelian dialectic that's been used for how many, probably thousands of years upon populations by political, agendas. And it's I don't think it's very particularly difficult to figure out. It just takes a moment to really sit with it and look. And for example, like, let's think about China and their huge population of like 1.435 billion people. Okay. And if you look at the statistics from, I think it was 2017, okay, you have a 33 out of 100,000 people die from the flu every year. And if you do the math, basically it works out to be 1.5 million people. Okay, so 1.5 million people in China yearly, and increasingly so, die from pneumonia, flu, respiratory illness that they've lumped under that label. Okay. I've not heard alarm bells going off, you know, hyper craziness of news and what about this?
Great point.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, but now all of a sudden we have this. And, you know, last year, actually, I was looking at what was the scandal last year. I guess they like to do this around, you know, they're very religious, they're very cultish. The people that rule us are very cultish, so they like their spring attack, when the light begins to come back in this part of the world. They love to do these strange rituals. And last year it was measles. They were freaking us out about measles.
It was, you're right, I remember. Isn't it interesting you saying that now? We come to the final third of winter. We already see the days are getting a bit longer. We feel a bit better, Amanda. I'm out with my dogs in the morning and I'm delighted. Winter is over. And then you're beaten down with this. I didn't consider that. That it's almost like, don't start to feel too good now. You know, here we go with some. Isn't that amazing? And you believe that's part of it as well. Keep people suppressed under, you know, almost like the sword of Damocles, you know, that you're always worried and nervous. You believe that's a part of it?
Oh, stress is probably the top killer among everything. When you've got stress thrown on, like, think about, you're already ill and then you've got stress attached to that. Now you're going to get sicker, because stress comes with an actual thought form that links to an actual chemical reaction in the body, as Candace Pert proved many years ago. Bruce Lipton talks about all of these, you know, very great minds. We know the science is for real, that that happens, that cortisol levels go up, adrenaline's affected, your adrenal glands are affected. It's very physical. And one of the things I'm studying right now is the polyvagal theory, and understanding that we actually have subconscious cues that affect our stress levels that we can't even control with our thinking mind, and that we have to actually put ourselves out of fight and flight and into proper deep breathing and so forth to actually switch out of a complete different nervous system activity of the body. And that's very physical, it's very chemical and measurable. And this is a part and parcel of ensuring that we are not able to be strong enough, clear-headed enough, grounded and logical enough to stop what is actually going on. If you're stressed, you're going to be sicker. And that's just a fact. So, of course, the fear programming comes on thick. And, I mean, I haven't had a TV in like 20 years, and I don't plan on getting one, you know.
My God, that's amazing. I can't, because of the nature of the job I do. But tell me, we're going to go to the top of the hour, and please God you'll come back again in the near future, right? But we're going to go to the top of the hour. What was that? How do you feel throwing the television out? How has that impacted on you health-wise? What has it done for you?
Well, what's interesting is, one thing you learn when you stop something that is a habit is you learn how addicted you actually were to that habit. The first 2 weeks, generally, when you quit something that you've been doing habitually, are the toughest, few weeks, because you have had a habit that you formed, and now you're forming a new habit. And so I went through sort of a interesting detox. Now, I've always been very good at meditating and getting my mind back to myself, and, you know, doing things that are healthy for my body, going into nature and being busy and reading. And I always have other activities, so it wasn't that difficult for me to, you know, not come home and then turn it on. There were many other things that I was excited to learn and to do. So it wasn't that traumatic for me. But what I did notice is, after about a couple of weeks, first of all, I didn't miss it. And secondly, I realized, when I would see the TV, maybe at somebody else's house or catch it at a bar or wherever I would be, it was as if you ever watch a soap opera and then you stop and then you go to the soap opera again and you realize it's the same stories right. over and over again.
Recycled.
So it was like that. It's like, I'm really not missing anything. I've not missed a thing. And in fact, if I'm worried about news or events or whatnot, I have the internet and it's everywhere. And guess what? Someone will walk up to me and say, "Hey, did you hear that thing that happened?" then I'll know to go and look. I was missing absolutely nothing, and it felt great. And
Did your interaction with your immediate neighbors, and your neighbors, did that increase? Did you notice that you were speaking to people more face to face once you got rid of the telly?
Well, absolutely, I had to do other things, right? And one thing I did notice is I did go out more, and it prevented me from going to sort of a lazy slump. I think the programming is, you get up, you hustle, you commute to work, you work your buns off, you get home, and now you deserve to just sit on your buns and watch TV
and have a beer.
Because you worked so hard, right? Yeah. And I got out of that thinking. So really, when I would work or when I was going to school, I was very much more social. I was very much more interactive with people, and I was very much more aware of what was going on with people. And I definitely recommend, at least if you can't stop, if it is part of your job or you do need to do something involved with the television, at least take long breaks where you get like a detox from it for a while. And you really learn something when you do that, when you take a break.
No doubt about it. I want to just remind our listeners, if you're joining the program right now, we are delighted to have Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer live on the radio show. She's in Canada, Ontario, Toronto. And she runs the Yummy Mummy Emporium and Apothecary in Minden, Ontario, Canada. And she supplies natural solutions for people there for disease, for detoxing, and many other things as well. She's a doctor of naturopathic medicine, and at one time she's worked at the University of Alberta in Canada as well as a lab animal technician there. Now, you talked about problem reaction solution. I want to come back to that, because just to remind our listeners again, Amanda's contention is that the coronavirus is basically a hoax. She's made a very compelling case why she believes that, and that ultimately the payoff for those who push the hoax is manifestly changing people. Isn't that right, Amanda? Changing how we think, but changing how we feel, and maybe moving us into places where we are more likely to accept more rules, maybe more regulations, things that previously we might have thought were totalitarian. Is that right, that they move us to this place where we become more malleable, more pliable? They can do with us what they want to do.
Yeah, and it becomes part of the culture and the cult think that this is, to be expected. We have viruses. You touch a doorknob, you're going to get sick. You're afraid of. You become afraid of what's around you. You become afraid of other people. They sneezed and now I'm going to get sick.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do is ease people's minds and help them understand that if they treat their bodies with respect, they don't use the pie hole here as a garbage, dump.
Yeah.
And they stop poisoning themselves with, booze, cigarettes, tons of marijuana, whatever their habits are, junk food, etc. If they actually take care of their bodies, which is their terrain, you don't catch things. You don't get, that's not how you develop, you make your sickness, you earn your sickness. That's how you get sick. You build it, right? You don't just run around and catch it. An individual who is strong, meaning they eat, they get their vitamins and their minerals through their food. Ideally, if in this world, you pretty much have to use supplements now because everything's so poisoned. You get outside in nature, you get enough sunlight, you swim in the lakes, you drink fresh spring water, you work with nature, you're going to be taken care of. You're not going to be taken out.
Yeah.
You're going to be protected because you've made sure your own body is vital.
I want to ask you about something. I want to, because I heard you mention marijuana there. By the way, in a minute, I want to ask you a little bit about World Cancer Day. You will know that the Cancer Act here in the UK, which came in the 1930s, forgive me for not remembering which year, 32, 35, I can't remember.
34, I think,
34,
yeah.
Well done. If you declare on radio in the UK that something cures cancer other than radiotherapy, well, you might be in hot water, you might be in trouble. But I want to talk about it because Shannon Doherty, whom, obviously a very famous actress in the news today, God help her, struggling with stage 4 cancer, radiotherapy. It just gets me thinking, I'm no fan of radiotherapy, so we might talk a little bit about that in a minute. But you mentioned marijuana. You didn't say cannabis, which I find very interesting. And you've obviously made a distinction there, because some of our listeners, their ears would have pricked up and they would have said, what's Amanda talking about? We believe that cannabis, or they might say marijuana, it has healing properties. What did you mean when you said marijuana?
Well, when I say marijuana, what I'm implying is the smoking of it habitually or addictively, where you're using it, you know, chronic smokers. Because what happens when you smoke anything, even if it's an herbal, it will still create combustion products in the lung tissue, which your body does have to actually remove. So there is still some level of toxicity with it. And also, if you're doing anything habitually and leaning on something like that, it's an abuse, period. It's an abuse. You're overdoing it. And with medicine, which it is a medicine, even nicotine's a medicine, these are plants. They have medicinal properties. But with all medicine, it has its correct dosage and its correct application. And it has different applications and dosages for different situations or diseases, if you will, in the body. And to just, you know, smoke it all over the place, I don't recommend doing that. How I employ cannabis is through topical application, and especially through working with DMSO and dimethyl sulfoxide, because it opens up the barriers to the skin and it allows better absorption of all these medicines. So you can use less, so you have less issues of detoxing through the liver, which even things that are natural still have to go through a processing in the body. It doesn't just magically poof disappear. Things are utilized and broken down, even your own cells have to be utilized and then broken down, and those can be considered toxins if they are, you know, rotating through your bloodstream or your lymphatic system for any length of time. And also for edibles, I think there's an excellent place to use cannabis properly as edibles. I think that's the appropriate use mostly of the medicine. If you are inhaling, at least using a vaporizer to remove a lot of the combustion particulates, but you're still going to have a different effect, right? That's a more psychological or mind effect. I mean, for myself, I can't do it. I mean, my nervous system gets affected quite negatively. It's not for everyone. And I know there's some Rasta men out there that are like, yeah, I'm doing that all day.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Right.
But, yeah. I've never touched it myself, but it's amazing you mentioned the edibles. We could talk about the oil, but I want to move on to cancer. We know the oil has proved wonderful in treating people with very severe epileptic disorders, forms of epilepsy I can't pronounce, but I've had Irish women on and English women on that have been in the news. They've struggled to get it. You know what, Amanda? It reminds us that we do live in a lunatic asylum, don't we? When you've got a naturally occurring plant, oil can be extracted from it. It isn't toxic. It does wonderful things, and yet governments tell people you can't have it. But then we know governments. You must have seen, maybe you did, maybe you didn't, what a wonderful interview Robert F. Kennedy did on RT America last weekend, where he brilliantly described to the journalist, to the woman who was interviewing him, he explained to her about the revolving door between the FDA and Big Pharma. And he highlighted one example of where a recent FDA, not chief executive, but the most senior woman in the FDA in recent years, left the FDA, went to work for Big Pharma, having made a number of serious decisions while at the FDA that directly benefited Big Pharma. So these are important issues to be talking about. I want to talk about cancer. People like you, I've listened to one or two people like you over the years. I only listen to people I believe to be credible. I'm very discerning about the people I speak with. And I believe you to be very credible and very honest and very qualified. So I'm fascinated by what you're telling me. I've come to believe, and I'm a layman, so I don't know anything really, but I've come to believe that the answer to every ailment is in the mind, but also is in every naturally occurring plant on planet Earth. Am I right? And does that mean cancers? Whatever the type, whether it be tumours embedded in the lungs or whether it be tumours in the brain, is the answer to those things that we are so scared of on World Cancer Day, is the answer out there in the natural world?
There are so many answers, it's really embarrassing. I'm embarrassed for the groups, the cancer societies, and all of these little arms of the pharmaceutical industry that pretend they actually are doing research and pretend they actually care about the health of people. And while they rake in billions of dollars to line their own pockets with, I'm sad for them, I'm embarrassed for them. They're ignorant. There's between 300 and 600 cures for cancer. In one of my YouTube videos, one of the earliest videos I've done, it was all about cancer cures, the suppression, how the chemical medicine, you know, took over and damaged homeopathic hospitals in the UK and made sure that they were, you know, removed and sort of the war, the real war was to, you know, destroy our beautiful natural remedies and to make sure that we didn't really study them, that they were hidden away from the population. And again, because you can make billions and billions and trillions really of dollars selling this false cure, the suppression, which is really what the chemical medicine offers, is simply suppression of symptoms, to completely disallowing a holism or a holistic understanding of how the organ systems work together, the basic biochemistry and the reliance on vitamins and minerals to actually run the systems. And to actually deplete those systems by the giving of those chemical medicines, which will always worsen the individual. And anyone who has done, you know, chemo and radiation, they're in a spot of danger because all they've done is suppressed the actual mechanism, which was the body trying to regulate itself and heal itself. And the tumor, the mass, is really a product of the body's inability to complete the detox of the materials that have caused problems, or because the cells have not been able to communicate properly with one another and remove debris, and also there can be DNA damage. And we're actually seeing an increase in cancers. I mean, it's really one of the top three killers next to iatrogenic medicine, which iatrogenic medicine is doctor-caused death. That's in the top three of death, next to heart disease and cancer, by the way.
Is that right? Hang on, Amanda, that's fascinating. Is that mistakes made by practitioners? Is that what you mean?
There's mistakes are lumped in. It's either
misdiagnosis or, yeah.
Right, mistakes or just they die at the hands of them, even by applying things that they've been, you know, thinking that they're doing correctly. But usually medical error is high percentage of iatrogenic deaths. But it also can be applied the medicine correctly and they die. So, but yeah, it's very high numbers.
Mind blown.
Right? So think about that. The cancer issue is, like you alluded to, there's an emotional component, which if you study German New Medicine, which I have not extensively, but definitely quite interested in understanding, again, the emotional side to disease, the electrical side to disease, and how that cellular communication really begins to break down metabolically, and you lead to all of these situations. Now, there's going to be, you know, buildup of toxins in all different tissue types. So then you have what's called histology, which just means the different types of tissue in different areas. So you have brain tissue, you'll have lung tissue, etc., right? And those all can become damaged. And then you get all the names, you get all the different variety of names and of cancers and all the staging and grading and all this stuff. But really it comes down to cleaning up the body. You have to detox in order to heal it, and you have to detox the original, whatever the original emotional issue was that came in. Either it was a shock trauma that started it off. And what was interesting is one of the studies I read on cancers was that a shock trauma could come from a cancer diagnosis from your doctor.
Right.
So you could actually get secondary cancers from being told you have cancer. And that was quite fascinating on how the human psyche works.
Hey, by the way, Amanda, sorry for the interruption. There will be people screaming at me because we go out on multiple platforms, including mainstream commercial platforms, and there will be people wanting me to jump at you and to take you on in your contention about trauma and cancer. But I'm not going to do that because I'm open-minded to it. I'm open to it. I am. You know, I'm not saying I wholeheartedly digest what you're saying and believe it, but I'm very open to it. And I'm interested in what you said about German new medicine, because a number of people have tweeted about that on my Twitter feed as well. I want to remind our listeners, it's 20 minutes or 19 minutes to the top of the air, the Richie Allen Radio Show, Salford, Greater Manchester, live on multiple platforms, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. We've got Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer. I can see Amanda, but she can't see me, because there is no webcam in this studio. But I know that Amanda is streaming this on her Facebook page, which is a good thing. And you can find her, there's only one Amanda Vollmer on Facebook, there's only one. So find her there. She's on Twitter as well. This is fascinating and very important stuff, I do believe. Now, let's segue. Cancer, 5G. I've had people like Chris Busby on this programme, an old friend of the programme, a certifiable expert in non-ionising radiation, one of the world's leading minds on it. Chris did amazing work in Iraq back in 2003 when babies were being born with deformities in Fallujah. Amazing guy, depleted uranium, brilliant guy. Brought him on the programme. What's going to happen with 5G, Richie? And he said the implications for human health are beyond anything most of us can even comprehend. Speaking of cancer, Amanda, are we going to see, as 5G becomes part of our lives, as it becomes more widespread, are we going to see the impact of it very quickly? What do you think?
Well, if you want to take Wuhan, China as an example, the deaths happening, which we say it's a hoax. It is a hoax, meaning the causation is a hoax, but the deaths are not a hoax. They're dying, and they're dying because in October they turned on a proportion of their 5G in that area, and that depresses the functional immune system of the body. It damages the blood, and they have done tests with not just 5G, 4G, and other radiation. We already are being damaged by it now. We had information back decades ago. Dr. George Carlo, he did tons of research on cellular damage to the DNA of the body. And what it does is it breaks off portions of DNA from your existing DNA that then segue off and segment off and can settle in other parts of the body. And they can actually blend with other materials and have a life of their own, which is basically a type of cancer when you have, you know, a broken cell that doesn't know what it's doing, that can't apoptose or can't have its own programmed cell death. And so it will proliferate erroneously. And this is not new, right? And now we just have industry pushing forward the technologies without proper testing, which they have not done. And when we do see this, the areas with 5G turn on, what happens is death, tree death, animal death. And then China is part of this 5G problem as well, because they can't overcome their pollution anymore. Their blood, their red blood cells and their white blood cells are now unable to actually remove the toxins properly from the body. How are you supposed to overcome such assaults like this? If 5G comes to my area, I'm moving far away. I'm not. It can't be tolerated. It's beyond cancer. You're going to see seizure disorders. You're going to see mental problems that are like beyond schizophrenia. It's not going to be pretty.
Amanda. You believe this is a given. There isn't any. This is not worst case scenario. Possibly might happen. You're convinced this is going to happen. Just like my previous guest, they are certain that there isn't anything anybody can do about this. If you're subjected to it, you can't detoxify from it. You can't reject the effects of it or push them away, because it's constant, because it's going to be around you. You're convinced of it. You sound so certain. It's very worrying, this.
Well, okay, so you can always do something against an assault. There's always things you can do. But I'm saying we're getting into a place where there's so many assaults happening on so many levels that it's getting more and more difficult to heal yourself naturally, to use things that are, you know, logical to, you know, protect yourself from electromagnetic fields, which there are things that you can do. It's just that when you're continually bombarded, it can weaken the system. It'll either happen quickly or it'll happen slowly, depending on your vitality and depending on your youth, depending on how rapidly your body can deal with it. It's just how the physical body can handle it. Now, if you were to introduce something slowly, what happens in the body is you develop an enzyme system against whatever that is. Enzymes are very important in the body because that's how you build up sort of a tolerance. You know, when people drink alcohol and they haven't in a while and they drink a little bit and then they're all kind of loopy.
Yeah.
Like that would be me. But somebody who habitually drinks, it takes a lot of drinks in order for them to feel the effects. Well, that's because their enzyme systems are upregulated. So they're making more enzymes to then deal with all of the alcohol in their body. And it has this effect for many different aspects of our lives and to a point. And that's if it's, you know, a slow introduction, not a sudden shock to the body. So we're going to see some real, you know, the zombie apocalypse is upon us, basically. Right. How you're going to have a thought and then you're immediately going to forget what you just thought about, because we're electrical beings. You can't just keep putting all of this electromagnetic radiation around us and expect our electrical circuits to work properly. How is that going to happen? I already experience it when I'm in a high EMF field area. I have a meter. I can actually read where the high EMFs are. And I do suggest people to buy a really good one. It's really helpful to know, like in your bedroom, is it really high? I suggest people turn off their connections at night, turn off their phones, don't have it near them, you know, when they're sleeping. You know, make sure your room where you sleep is very clean. Even dirty electricity is a problem. So you should unplug your, you know, devices that are close to your head. A lot of people, they can't sleep and they come to me and say, I can't sleep. I said, well, first of all, let's look at your sleep hygiene. Do you have any lamps plugged in close to your head? You know, even if they're off. Oh yeah, I said, unplug those and then let me know how you're sleeping. And so many of them go, couldn't even realize that that was going to be affecting my sleep. So think, if that can affect someone's sleep, what is this going to do?
So do you think, Amanda, do you think investing in one of those EMF reading meters is a good decision, do you think, for people?
I think it's going to be helpful for a lot of people to navigate the background radiation that they're being exposed to. I think it's very challenging. Again, it's something you can't really see with your own two eyes. You can feel it if you're sensitive enough, but it is a wise investment to have, so you can get an idea of what's coming off of your devices and how much you're getting, your exposure levels, really. And the government should be regulating exposure levels, and they stopped regulating that like 10 years ago, because if they were, the current level of Wi-Fi that's happening wouldn't be happening, because it would be too dangerous. They would say, well, sorry, we can only have so many Wi-Fi connections in this square, you know, mile of living, because it will be too high. The background radiation is too damaging. But they've stopped caring about that, clearly.
Dreadful story in UK media today. I'm guessing in Canada, where you're based, I'm guessing in the States, it's probably the same. Half of the UK's children have now got a smartphone, half of them. And increasingly, children aged 5 and 6, and again, I'm reluctant to say anything to you because you know this stuff inside out, but obviously the underdeveloped skulls of very small children are obviously susceptible to the radiation coming from these phones. Half. Just before I go any further, by the way, I can be a bit of an eejit, as we say in Ireland sometimes, a bit of an eejit. I mentioned something earlier on. I confused the audience. It wasn't the FDA. Julie Gerberding was the director of the Centre for Disease Control for 7 years in the last decade, 2002 to 2009. And this woman is as bent, as corrupt as they get. Every decision she ever made was a decision that benefited the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. When she left the CDC, which is supposed to regulate Big Pharma. She went to work for Merck. And that's what Robert F. Kennedy was talking about in his interview with RT. So again, apologies. I didn't have any notes to hand there. We're lucky this hour to have Dr. Amanda Dawn Vollmer live on the radio show. We've been talking about what's going to happen. There is a bit of good news, though, Amanda. We've seen in Europe, we've seen in California and other parts of the US, there is definitely opposition to 5G. And it's not going away. Concerned ordinary men and women like me and my friends, they're going to their local authorities and saying, no, absolutely not. You've not tested this. It's deadly. We want you to put a moratorium on it. And they're having some success. Does that give you a bit of cause for optimism?
Yeah, absolutely. And even just having a conversation like we are having and understanding how many people are listening and also the conversation is getting louder. And I have noticed that. And that's also something to feel optimistic about. And then as well to feel empowered that you can also, as a listener, as an audience, share the information and talk about it openly and not be afraid to have those conversations, those maybe difficult conversations with people. So to open their minds to the thinking and to speak out and to say no, because the way that governments operate is based on tacit approval, which means if you don't say no, they assume you said yes, right? So we actually have to tell them no, and we have to tell them very loudly no, and even take them to court over it, which I'm sure if it's not already happening now, it will be. And this is the hope and also the optimism that more people are noticing, and also more people are getting sick from cellular radiation, you know, microwave radiation. You've got people who move out into the middle of the desert of Texas or the middle of the desert of Arizona who are ill from electromagnetic frequencies. They can't be around anything anymore. That's going to grow. We're going to get more and more little cities popping up that are completely free of any, even regular electricity. They're going to be off grid and they can't handle it because they're completely blasted from it. And there's actually a really good, I can't remember the name of the documentary, but I know there is a documentary about you know, electric smog and sickness and EMF sickness and what these people are going through and how they're trying to live their lives you know, amidst all of this.
How dreadful must it be for them, Amanda, when they have these problems and they go to their local MD or GP and they're told that they're crazy? You'll remember this. I watched a few years ago when the spin-off from Breaking Bad, of course, one of the biggest television shows of all time, the spin-off is called Better Call Saul. And somebody who manages public life must have known that Better Call Saul was going to be one of the biggest TV shows ever, which it is because it's a prequel. And they wrote this story about Chuck the lawyer, the older brother of Jimmy, who has electro-hypersensitivity disorder, but yet they make it out that he's crazy. And yes, this is how they put stuff in the public domain. And I remember watching this and I thought, that is the establishment doing a story, basically telling people, forget about this EMF disorder. It doesn't exist. It's crazy. Wow. And it is real. I do believe it. I know people who suffer from it. They're not crazy, but they can't go to their GP, Amanda, because they're told it's psychosomatic. There's something else wrong with you. There's no such thing. But there is, patently, obviously, people who do suffer when they are exposed to EMF.
That's right.
Mad.
It's just like fibromyalgia, same thing. I mean, how many people have been told that they're crazy, put on psych meds, and really it's a very deeply physical disorder. And it's completely insulting to the individual. And, you know, that industry, the medical industry, is very egotistical. So they have to talk down to their patients. They're told and taught just from first year med school that you're the best of the best. So you're awesome and everyone else is stupid. So when you have your patients, they're going to think they know stuff, but they don't. So you don't listen to them. You tell them what to do. And that's how most of the MDs operate. And I can tell you how many stories I have heard from my own clientele of this really disrespect to the individual who knows what's going on in their own body. They know something is deeply wrong and they're trying to get help. And they're then ignored, really, or, you know, gaslighted by the doctors.
They're under some pressure too, Amanda. I agree with what you've said, but to be the devil's advocate for a minute, they're under enormous pressure. Here in the UK, the National Health Service, as you know, it's free at the point of use for everybody. So you get an appointment to see a GP, it's free, and the medicine prescribed is free, depending on your income or whatever. But increasingly, the workload and the pressure being put on doctors, you see these days it's common for somebody to go into a practice to get an appointment. They sit with a doctor who types stuff into a computer, who doesn't do a blood test, doesn't do blood pressure tests, doesn't do any of that, makes an assumption and gives them a prescription. It's terrible, but it's also down to the fact that the pressure being put on them by governments is extraordinary. It sounds like every man, woman and child, or every man and woman of mature age, we need to have a long, hard look at our relationship with medicine, don't we? And our relationship with our bodies.
Yeah, it goes like this. You go to the MD, there's a problem now, and then you go to another specialist to try to get more information. And then, you know, a lot of time is taken driving, going to appointments, waiting in waiting rooms. This sort of thing goes on for a while, and only to be told either they have to have a surgery, they can try this experimental drug, it may or may not work, they're not sure. They can go on a stronger drug of the drug they're already on, or they can go on more drugs. And it ends up that the individual doesn't get well, or they get worse, and then they get frustrated, they feel unheard, and they eventually turn to someone like me. And I hear that story and then have to clean them up, get them off the meds, you know, get them normalized again. And, you know, it happens again and again where they walk away completely resolved, and it's like they're like, well, why didn't my doctor do that, or why didn't my doctor know that, or why didn't they tell me that I was deficient in this or I needed that, or why didn't they tell me that the statin I was on depletes CoQ10, which sets me up for having a heart attack, which we've known in the literature for like 15 years. Why are they not automatically giving me CoQ10 knowing that the statin depletes it? Like, what's going on here, right? So there's more and more of these disgruntled types that I see literally every day. And I take them out of their frustration and empower them into what they can do for their own bodies. Because I think this, in the overarching, you know, philosophical view, how I see it, is that we're getting really, the old shoe is, it's getting really stinky, and we're kind of moving on to, we know there's more out there that we can do, and we don't need to do this anymore, and we've tried it, and we're just giving up on that. And I think people are going to be exhausted, even if it's free. You can't keep giving away poison for free, and people are just going to keep taking it. I mean, it's free in Canada too.
Yeah,
we have that type of healthcare. I don't want anything to do with it. I don't attend. I've been fired by my doctor already years ago. I don't attend. I don't need them. There's a really good book called Fire Your Doctor. I recommend reading. You know, and that's really where it needs to get to, I think. But I think it's to, for us to become spiritual adults, if you know what I mean. It's like for us to take self-responsibility for our own health rather than give the power away to somebody else. Say, just do it to me, you know?
Fix me, doc.
It's like, no, it's time that you take control of your life and actually learn what you need to do to take responsibility for your vessel.
That is an amazing thing, because very senior GPs, older GPs, old school from, you know, pre-World War II, including our family GP, a great woman, would always say, I can't tell you what's wrong with you. Only you can tell me what's wrong with you. We're just about out of time, so I want to remind our listeners, to find Amanda online, go to yummymummyemporium.org. Yummymummyemporium.org. You've been listening to Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer, and she runs the Yummy Mummy Emporium in Minden, Ontario, Canada, supplying natural solutions for people to help them with dealing with disease and chronic illness. She's got a book coming out in April or thereabouts, and I do hope, Amanda, you'll come back on in April to talk to us about the book and to get into more of these issues, because we've really enjoyed having you on today. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the programme today. I'll give you the final word. Thanks again, and continued success to you, I do look forward to the book coming out. Final word to you on health and on our relationship with it, and we'll leave it for today. I've got about 30 seconds before we've got to go. Thanks again.
Thank you, Richie. Again, I appreciate you having me on and the time to be able to speak to everyone and to help people understand that there's more going on in the world than you may think, and to really start to look at your own habits and behaviors, the food you're eating, the water you're drinking, the air you're breathing, and understand that it's toxins and poisons from your either your own mind, emotions, and stress, or the outer world that's causing illness and disease. And that's, if you want to overcome that, if you want to protect yourself from the flu, then you detox and you heal the body, and really look to your own self and your own power to help yourself. And the information is available, you just have to look. Okay,
real, so that's real pleasure, Amanda. I mean it. Thanks so much for your time today. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. Stay in touch and come back when your book is ready and it's published. Thanks so much for coming on. Thanks, Amanda. Dr. Amanda D. Vollmer, live on the line from Ontario in Canada, closes out the Richie Allen Radio Show for Tuesday, February the 4th, 2020. I'll be back on the live stream crap, the YouTube bollocks tomorrow at 9:30. So join me there if you feel like it. Until then, leaving you with this from Journey. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks for listening to the show. Bye for now. Bye.